Everyone's staying in. Everyone getting on. Most of the time. Every extra thing we're having to do, every plan we put on hold, every sacrifice we're making. Everyone who stays at home is helping stop the spread of COVID-19. Because the less we leave home, the less likely we'll come into contact with the virus. Everything we're doing is making a difference. Let's keep going. Stay home. Protect the NHS. Save lives.
Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name is Adam Brimelow, and this is our brand new season, COVID-19, 1 year on. In the coming weeks, we'll be delving into different aspects of the pandemic as we both reflect back and look ahead to the next phase for the NHS. In this first episode, we're delighted to have a panel of leading national journalists, Hugh Pym from the BBC, Kat Lay from The Times, and Dennis Campbell from The Guardian, on their experiences of reporting the pandemic and the challenges they've faced in telling its true story. There are some great insights and recollections here. I'm sure you'll find it fascinating. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers. And keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.
The pandemic has been a pivotal moment in our country's story, shaking society to its foundations, shattering lives and, as we know, tearing families and friends apart. It's upended the economy, closing schools and, of course, piling wave after wave of pressure on health and care services. And telling that story in a balanced, fair-sighted and accurate, authoritative and compelling way is a huge responsibility at a time of national emergency. Our guests in the Provider Podcast have borne that burden, also that privilege, for month after month, helping to shape and interpret a pandemic narrative that's still unfolding with the NHS and the role of trust and frontline staff right at its heart. So Hugh, Dennis and Kat, welcome. Thank you for your time. Let's start with the editorial challenges that the pandemic has posed. Going back to February and March last year, as the virus really started to take off around the world. Perhaps I could start with you, Hugh. At what point did you and your editors realise that health issues would have to override all other societal norms and all other stories? And how did you adapt to that editorially?
I think there were scientists and medical experts who realised before some of us did in the media, not all of us. I suppose it was, if you look at sort of moments, it was that first couple of cases being detected in York, which made everybody feel this was something very, very substantial. And I think by early February, it was becoming clear this would dominate our lives for a certain amount of time because it was so fast moving. But it goes without saying, none of us imagined then how things would develop. And of course, policymakers, ministers, NHS leaders were all learning as they went along. And we as journalists were trying to keep up and they were trying to keep up as well. So the whole thing moved at such fast pace. It was very difficult to stand back because everything was changing each day. I mean, the whole government line changed, didn't it? From trying to push the peak into the summer and then bring it down again to a suppression strategy lockdown. Having to adapt to sort of changes in tact like that as journalists was quite extraordinary how everything developed there.
Dennis, was there a tangible sense for you of sort of moving up very quickly through the gears and finding out you were running out of gears to move up to?
Yes, I think we live in an age of routine hyperbole, particularly in the media, but I think this was and remains the biggest story of all time, of any of our lives. It was also a story that was hugely fast moving, hugely complex, really puzzling to work out what was going on, who to believe, what was right, what wasn't, and hugely challenging to cover. The Guardian, all the journalists of The Guardian started working from home almost pretty much immediately. That was sort of strange and counterintuitive, because journalism generally requires journalists to go to places and talk to people and harvest what information and so on you can, and right off the back of that. And we were unable to do that. I think it's incredible in a way that so much good journalism has continued on a remote basis alongside everything else.
And Cam, what was it like for you at the Times?
Well, I came back off maternity leave in March last year. So I was back in the office for one day before we all got sent home to work from home indefinitely. I think what was striking was the speed at which public opinion on everything changed, in tandem with sort of the thinking politically and scientifically about what we'd need to do. I mean, we were looking at what was happening in China and then in Italy, and seeing them impose what seemed like quite stringent lockdowns. And, you know, almost one day you had opinion pieces going, that will never work here, the British public will never stand for that kind of restriction. And within days, that was what was actually happening.
So COVID very quickly became the number one story, the overriding story. You needed to get information, reliable information, on all kinds of facets of the pandemic as it quickly became. How easy or how difficult was that, Hugh?
I think it was easy to the extent that people were prepared to talk to us. And I'm sure, you know, Dennis and Kat had their contacts. So our contacts within the NHS at senior levels and in Whitehall, not to mention other parts of the UK, were prepared to talk, but they were learning. I mean, everything was moving so fast for them. So I felt, actually, people I spoke to were incredibly helpful, but they didn't always know anything from week to week or day to day about the latest developments. So I found it easy to talk to people, but, you know, one conversation one evening might have been completely in history by the time of the next conversation. And I think those press conferences, I think early on, Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance became very well known, and we were getting press conferences and the chances to ask questions. Obviously, since then, there's been a big debate about who did what, when, and what decisions were made. So I don't think there was a problem of getting information at that early stage. The question is, how valuable was the information within 48 hours, given how things had moved on?
I suppose that really deals with information from the centre, doesn't it? From those Downing Street briefings. Dennis, did you have any difficulties in terms of getting behind that story in terms of what was actually happening at the front line?
Right. In normal times, I enjoy good relations with a large number of NHS trusts. I did have difficulties with the NHS England central media team based in London. I don't say this lightly, but there were a number of occasions in which the NHS England central comms team told me things which were not true and which they must have known to be untrue. One example, myself and a colleague wrote a story about how the London Nightingale Hospital, then a subject of great fascination and hope at the time, was, contrary to what had been said, was only going to admit relatively healthy patients. Several doctors who were working there shared information with us to tell us this. We wrote a story saying that. I got a call that morning, the day of publication, from someone senior in the NHS England media team saying, your story is completely wrong. I've spoken to the clinical director of the London Nightingale and he says your story is completely wrong. And I said, well, I know my story is right, so we're sticking to it. And about 10 days later, the Health Service Journal, fantastic publication that it is, got hold of the NHS England official plan for the clinical base for admission to the hospital. And indeed, it bore out exactly what we'd reported 10 days earlier. That's just one example, but it was difficult and frustrating and sometimes impossible to get good quality information from sort of the official sources. To tally in with what Hugh said, I think myself and others were health journalists who'd been around were for a while, we're saved by the quality of the contacts, the numbers we've got on our phones, the people who will speak to you either on the phone or send you a direct message or WhatsApp, people who will use non-official NHS channels privately behind the scenes and ignore sort of slight pressure from sort of the NHS thought police PR people, and they will talk to you. And I found some of those people hugely useful. So it was a mix of deliberate obstruction and outright denial sometimes of things that were true, but also great help from chief executives, doctors, and others in the system.
And certainly our experience was that there was a great hunger for information, and the connection that we had through our organisation with Frontline Trust was invaluable in terms of being able to provide you and your colleagues with real insight into Frontline. And I think that helped to propel us to a prominent role, which has been sustained throughout the pandemic. I think one interesting challenge around all this is obviously because it's been such a time of national emergency, and that sort of that shapes the whole external environment in which you're operating, doesn't it? When you have a situation where the Prime Minister is perilously ill, that sense of everyone pulling together, shared national endeavour, overwhelming gratitude to NHS and other frontline staff. How much did that affect your editorial approaches to covering the twists and turns of the pandemic? Kat?
I think it's probably more a case of it affecting the prominence that stories were given rather than sort of any particular changes in the lines that were taken or how we covered the story. I mean, I think because it was touching on everyone's lives and touching on every aspect of people's lives, it very quickly was clear that it's not just a health story. So, you know, I have been writing about the struggles that hospitals have faced, issues with things like access to PPE, you know, all of these very health-led stories. But my colleagues working the education beat, they've been incredibly busy looking at the impact on school children and what it means for their future. And it has become quite a political story. I mean, our Westminster team have been taking the lead on a lot of the coverage simply because the decisions being taken go far beyond the health impacts of the pandemic and we'll touch on every aspect of people's lives, you know, the economy, the furlough scheme. I mean, it's impossible to list because it is everything.
There were moments of real national drama, weren't there? Particularly at those times when, I'm thinking particularly when Boris Johnson was so ill, but other key moments, you must have really felt that you were at the heart of a story that would be absolutely seminal in the telling the story of our country. And Hugh, you were on the 10 o'clock news day after day telling that story. How conscious were you of the kind of responsibility sitting on your shoulders trying to articulate these momentous events?
I think, Adam, I mean, as you would remember from, you know, your days broadcasting and in broadcast journalism, on the day you get on with the job, and you have to think of the next outlet, what you're going to say. You don't get time to reflect for a little while about, you know, how big a story it is and was. But you're absolutely right to highlight the day that Boris Johnson went into intensive care. And that news broke early evening. And I just remember I was actually at home and I realised I had to get in fast. But the newsroom was almost in a state of not exactly shock, but suddenly realizing that we were on the verge of, you know, something tragic and catastrophic, personally for Boris Johnson potentially, but also for the future of government during this crisis. So that was one moment, certainly. Thankfully, obviously, he pulled through. But the other point you made about this balancing the need to get information out there with being responsible because of awareness of the impact of saying things that might cause unnecessary distress and having to be perfectly fair and accurate, but also sort of not, you know, not set hairs running that might cause needless worry, it is a very difficult balancing act. And we were very aware of that day by day, particularly I think being the BBC, serving our audiences but also trying to keep things in perspective and just get the balance absolutely right on that. And it remains a challenge, and it has been really ever since this started.
Dennis, when you think back to some of the key moments during the course of the pandemic, the sort of really pivotal moments, thinking of the Dominic Cummings trip to Durham, the controversy over PPE, failings over test and trace, the lead up to Christmas, would it not happen? And then, of course, more recently, the vaccination campaign. Are there key moments in this pandemic story that where you feel the story, you could feel a sense of shift, of direction, of where it was going?
Actually, the example, Adam, I would give would be from early on in the run-up to lockdown. About a couple of weeks beforehand, there was the Nuffield Trust Health Think Tank's annual two-day away day at a very nice venue down in Surrey. And I remember that Chris Whitty, who I think at the time was still a relatively unknown figure, he spoke and Matt Hancock spoke. And I remember Chris Whitty, said the gist of it, or the story that we all wrote from it, was Chris Whitty warning that major events may become unviable and that schools may have to close, and the idea that kind of all these sports events be cancelled. I remember sitting in the press media writing room afterwards thinking, really, is that really going to happen? Is he not kind of exaggerating? Is this not a bit of hyperbole? Is he trying to scare us? What's going on here? And of course, he was being completely calm and evidence-led. And meanwhile, just to my left, my counterpart from the Sun newspaper was compiling sort of a list helped by Google and Wikipedia about all the big sporting events that might have to be cancelled or have no fans at them, the FA Cup final, the Derby, Ascot, all these sorts of things. And I thought, well, that'll never happen. And of course, it all that was actually a taste of that was very much a foreboding, a taste of what was to come. So I actually think a number of health journalists, maybe including myself, it took us perhaps a little longer than perhaps it should have for the penny drop about the full enormity of that. But certainly that day, listening to Chris Whitty in particular, who then soon after became a sort of a nightly national fixture, that did help the penny to drop for me.
That feels like so long ago now, doesn't it? Those events you describe, just moving things a bit more up to date. Kat, when you reflect on sort of the NHS reputationally from what's passed over these last 12 months, where do you think it stands now in terms of its performance through the pandemic?
I think it's always the case with the NHS to an extent, but I think what people think about it is so rooted in their own personal experience. So people who know someone who has been hospitalised with COVID, for example, and are, you know, enormously grateful to the individual doctors and nurses and, you know, other healthcare staff that have saved their lives, will have a very different perspective to someone whose mum or dad had a cancer diagnosis delayed because of the focus on COVID. You know, and we're very aware, we're always made very aware when we write about the impact on other conditions that the NHS has continued to treat them. But there is undeniably this pocket of people who haven't come forward, haven't been diagnosed for whatever reason. And I think that is a real issue for the NHS to deal with, not just operationally, but also in terms of its reputation and its relationship with the general public. Because if everyone knows someone who was diagnosed late or who had that kind of poor experience, then that does cut through quite quickly.
I'd just like to move on to the way things have changed logistically for you as you've reported the pandemic. It's clearly reshaped the way we work. Obviously, it's meant remote working, but also health right at the heart of national debate every day. How have you had to adapt to reporting the pandemic in terms of the prominence and that incessant drumbeat of stories? Hugh, how has it changed the way you work?
Well, I've been going into the office most days because for TV news, you do need to be there, particularly if you're doing live updates with the newscaster on the main news bulletins. But that being said, there are colleagues who are working remotely, and you've got people editing remotely. So you've got a correspondent in one place, the editor who's putting it together on a laptop somewhere else, and the producer somewhere else. So you've got this virtual working for production of TV pieces, which and the same goes for radio, which I think is going to change the way we work in future. But I think the biggest change has been based at New Broadcasting House, getting interviews from all around the UK, all around the world on Zoom or Skype, and using video that's maybe done within hospitals by staff or patients at home, and putting something together that can still tell the story. In some ways, it's unveiled a sort of rich range of content we wouldn't normally get, because we'd have to send a crew halfway across the country to get, you know, 1 minute's worth of material. Now, we can't carry on with that indefinitely, because we are missing some of the sort of rich variety that you get by filming in person and proper interviews face to face. So we will go back to that, but it's opened up possibilities for the future and how we cover things and get different experiences. And people doing stuff on mobile phone videos have been very important to us. If we haven't been able to get in somewhere, somebody will do something for us. Could be within an NHS facility, which we wouldn't otherwise have got.
Dennis, you were nodding there. There's obviously been a lot of innovation going on. Which bits do you think will last, and what are the old ways of working do you expect to return?
Just to tie in with some of what Hugh just said, I think that a number of organisations have really raised their game and become much more open and accessible and accommodating to journalists. And think about, there's been a number of universities which are very strong in kind of the health and the science media centre in London, which acts as a kind of bridge of understanding between health and science journalists and scientists themselves. It's played a blinder. NHS providers, I'm not looking to flatter you, but the fact that you put out, for example, daily quotes every day, 7 days a week, from either Chris or Saffron, that was hugely useful. We had high quality, ready-made material reliably available at a time when it wasn't easy to get useful stuff elsewhere. Threads of tweets that Chris Hobson began using as another mode of communication, that was hugely useful as well. But also it did unlock help for people like myself from quite a lot of people in the NHS, people, doctors in particular, nurses, some of the Royal Colleges of Medicine, all of whose members were centrally involved, some of the medical societies, and even some of the health charities, all of whom knew different bits and pieces of what was going on somewhere else. And I think that it's been quite an enriching experience in that respect. We haven't just had to rely on the traditional channels, and I think and hope and expect that a lot of that will continue. I've certainly got a much wider range of contacts than I had a year ago, and I think I had pretty good contacts then.
And look, I agree with Dennis. NHS providers has been very helpful to us as journalists. And I think you said this earlier, you were able to reflect the views of trust leaders. I remember Chris, in the height of the first wave, being able to reflect how close hospitals were to very serious situations, which obviously reflected what was really going on. And he was prepared to, and the same with Saffron, you know, to step up there and tell us what was going on.
I remember Chris and Saffron both, again, you know, being very honest and open about the big problems in PPE supply for NHS frontline staff, and also being amongst the first people to be rightly cautious and sceptical about the claimed success, which of course turned out to be an illusion, of the government's test and trace programme. Things like this, they called it like it was, and by doing so, helped journalism and helped serve the public interest.
Well, thank you, all of you. The impact of the lockdown has affected us all, even if we may not have had COVID, and it's forced us to all to live and breathe this story and stay at the top of our game month after month. And that has brought a kind of incessant pressure, a kind of psychological pressure. Kat, how hard has it been for you to deal with that? The fact that your beat has been at the top of the agenda day after day, month after month.
It has been tough. It has been sort of a sustained pressure that you don't always get. Health is always a busy patch, but it does normally ebb and flow a bit more. So there is more chance for downtime and just that thinking space that can actually sometimes be when you have the best ideas for stories or, you know, leads to follow up. So I have felt the absence of that quite keenly. But it is very hard to work out or to, I suppose, reflect on how much of it is the pressure of a particular job that you're trying to do during the pandemic, and how much of it is simply what everyone is going through, you know, trying to work from home, juggle childcare and work at the same time, you know, not being able to go out and see your friends and decompress in that way, which you normally would do. So I wouldn't want to say it's been something I have experienced sort of uniquely. I think it's pressures that, you know, I've faced in common with a lot of other people.
Hugh, how has it been for you? I mean, you've been having to broadcast in so many of the main outlets for so long, so regularly. That's physically wearing, and you've just had to keep on going while keeping on top of the story.
Yeah, it has been tiring most points through all this, but I feel fortunate in many ways because I was going into work most times and just getting on with the job. And I just think of people who work from home but found that particularly stressful for reasons, you know, that Kat has alluded to, with family and young children and working from home and maybe missing the social contact of being at home. And of course, all those people who've lost jobs and really struggled. So it's been a privilege. I think you said that at the beginning, Adam, to be involved in covering this extraordinary story and doing our best to serve audiences. So I consider myself very fortunate. And I've got some great colleagues. There are so many, I'm sure it's the same at The Times and The Guardian. There are people who don't have bylines, don't get on TV, but do a lot of research, huge amounts of data analysis by colleagues and our online team who I benefit from, not to mention camera people, producers. So I feel very, very well supported and also by BBC management. So I think I'm lucky, and it's, as I say, it's been a privilege.
Dennis, it's been a tough road, obviously, this pandemic for so many people, and not least the reporters, the journalists covering it. How have you handled it, and how concerned are you that there's a good way to go with this?
So I would say it has been exhausting, you know, 12-hour days, feeling frazzled at the end of every day, not leaving, some weeks where I didn't leave the house in daylight from one weekend to the next, barely eating lunch, barely talking to my children who were homeschooling at the time. Exhausting, but also exhilarating as well, as a journalist, as a professional challenge. It's been exhilarating to have, if the, what I think is beyond contradiction, the biggest story of all time, if it had landed on the patch of one of my colleagues said had been, for example, an environmental catastrophe and the environmental team had been in the lead of all of that, I probably would have been jealous. If it had been a war or some international relations crisis and some other colleagues had been sort of in the driving seat. But instead I had the editor, the deputy editor, the news desk, everybody saying to me every day, what's going on? What's coming up? What should we be doing? And being absolutely central to what the Guardian was doing 5, 6, 7 days a week. I've never had that before. I'll probably never have it again. So exhausting, definitely, in a way that sometimes was in danger of sending me crackers, but also exhilarating, something I wouldn't have missed for the world.
Well, thank you, all of you, for sharing time in your very busy schedules to reflect on what's been happening over these last 12 months. Thanks also for the amazing work that you have done in covering the pandemic. It's been a real pleasure working with you, and good to speak to you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Adam. But you can buy us all lunch later.
Thanks so much. I really found that fascinating, actually. Really great to speak to you.